you call it. We just had a group conscience consisting of two incredible alcoholic minds.
We're going to have a three-hour meditation.
Yeah. And no doubt what will come out of that. We want to take just a minute before we get rolling and pose a little question to you. You know, everybody is here for a reason. You know, everybody came here either to get in out of the sun or whatever. But folks have got a reason for being here and something they're looking for. We've gone through some stuff this morning that I really enjoyed visiting. But part of our purpose is to try to help everybody here get what they're looking for the best we can. And so we're at a point, you've sort of seen that we make it up as we go. And so absolutely no way to get this train off track. It just stays there, you know, and then and it winds up getting on track in the process. Real quick, give us some feedback, if you would, in terms of what you'd like to see visited before we get out of here at quitting time today. And we'll see how well we can respond to that. Anybody?
You started to talk about how effectiveness and how you know whether you're being effective or not.
Yes, a little more depth on effectiveness. Okay.
I can tell you in one brief sentence. When we broke here, you were all standing out in the parking lot talking to each other. We have been incredibly effective. That's the marker.
Or else made you hungry.
at meetings. A good meeting, people hang out. They came early, they stay late, and they go do other things. That's what it's really about. If everybody breaks and goes home, there's something missing out of that. There's no spirit.
Alan mentioned a couple of things that I'll just throw out if it may, is in the general area of sponsorship. And I kind of alluded to that before we broke. A couple of real issues that are weighty for us and have to do with effective relationships is when do you discontinue a relationship and sponsorship if you just believe it's run its course? And how do you deal with that? Some people use a crude word like firing, but it's not necessarily that. It's just recognizing. The other thing is how you deal with people who are under medication, and it poses some real challenges in terms of discerning when you can do effective work, how to responsibly deal with it. Does that cover it adequately, Al? Okay. All right, those are good points, too.
I just would like to hear your experience with the steps.
With steps.
You know, maybe the fourth step or, you know, eighth step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When all else fails, go to the steps. Okay, good job. Anybody else? Pardon?
Dealing with really resistant people, but they keep showing up. I need guidance.
Hard cases, but persistent cases. Okay, yeah, how you deal with resistant people. My mind just takes off with that. But anybody else? Yeah, Will.
Dealing with remorse.
Remorse. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah, gotcha.
I'm dealing with sponsors that are really struggling with just functioning life. You know, they're depressed. They're, you know, the developments. Can't seem to get a job. Can't seem to get it together.
All dressed up with nowhere to go. Okay, yeah. Good deal. It could have been a contender. Anybody else? Of course, you know either one of those could go for a week. Yeah.
More about your experience with emotional and spiritual, emotional sobriety, spiritual growth, and ligaments in and out of the rooms in all areas of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts about that.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like all this knowledge I have, but actually,
that's an excellent thing, how you get it from the concept stage in the rooms into real stuff where we live. Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, one more. Like we didn't have enough to do. You remember all that, Don?
Self-supporting for your own contributions.
I'm sorry?
Being self-supporting for your own contributions.
Did you follow that?
Yeah, and I'm going home.
Help me just one thing. You said being self-supported through your own contributions. And then I couldn't quite follow that second part. I couldn't hear it quite.
Grounding your ideals in a power greater than yourself.
Yeah. Okay.
Did I speak up?
No, I heard it then. I'm just not incredibly brilliant. I have trouble following it sometimes. I'm having trouble connecting to self-supporting and that spiritual connection. Yeah, you've got a connection in there, but I'm...
Okay.
Okay.
You all obviously know that if we try to address those, we're going to be here till sometime in the middle of next week. However, if you allow us to tell some stories, we can illustrate each one of them, sometimes a couple of them, from our own experience, if that's suitable. I left my lecture notes at home, and I left my addressing this notes at home. But, yeah, I hear what you're saying. We've got personal experiences. You're talking about the application of spiritual principles in the real world, is the essence of what I heard coming out of here. How do you do that? Well, let me address remorse first. We'll get that done, because I know about that. Guilt is when I have been caught violating one of your rules or laws or principles, and I feel guilty. Very easy to deal with. I wait for you to tell me what kind of time I have to do. It's the payback. Then I do that, and as soon as that's done, or shortly before it's done, I just go my merry way. That's easy. Remorse and shame is when I have caught myself violating one of my principles, one of my true beliefs, violating who I am, and there is no payoff. I'm going to tell you a little story. This one hurts, but I like to keep it fresh because you've all got one. We all have an ace in the hole, father, mother, uncle. We've got a place where when all else fails, I can go back and rest for a few days. And my dad was that. And during the last part of my sickness, I was part of a subculture. I'm one of the freaks that came out of Berkeley, screaming out, "Where there's dope, there's hope, burn down City Hall." And we lived underground. There's a real culture out there. Anyway, we were resting, and Albert called me from Albuquerque. Albert was one of the snakes I ran with. And Albert said, we got 30 kilos of good marijuana as far as Juarez, and our driver got busted. And we need somebody to go get it. Now, get the whole picture. At the time, I'm a single parent to two little boys. One six and one four. I'm trying to be a parent, but we're on the road. Don't want to get too dramatic with it. Albert says, "We need somebody to get it. Would you do it?" And I said, "Of course, Albert." Now that should give you some dimension of where I'm at. Trying to keep these kids safe, and I just accept the job of smuggling 30 kilos of marijuana out of Juarez, Mexico. And I didn't do it for the money. I did it for prestige. I was the only one in the United States they could think of to call. To go into old Mexico. Get the job done. The truth was, Albert had been told to call me. They said, "Call Fritz because he's crazy." So anyway, we took the job. I stopped drinking and put on a little bit of weight. Did the math, got my head clear. The math was necessary. How much volume is there in 30 kilos of marijuana the way it was packed then? I needed to know, what kind of box can I put this in? I'm sane now. Yeah, well. I'm functioning. cleaned the boys up, cleaned me up, sport coat, young American, Teresa father. That's the role we're going to play. Had them rent a VW van in somebody else's name and had them get us a place to stay. At this point, I have nothing to do with the deal. If it falls apart before I get there, I'm not in it. I'm not stupid. I'm just insane. We got into Juarez. I got the van, got us into Juarez. I didn't pick the stuff up. It was laying in a motel. They picked it up and then transferred to me. The hotel they'd picked for us, of course, was just a whorehouse motel in Juarez. We immediately moved into the Holiday Inn-style place uptown, Teresa. That volume fits perfectly in a single air mattress. So I opened the end up and stuffed the mattress, then resealed it, put air in it. That cuts the smell down. Then on top of that, I put dirty diapers. And on top of that, I put my two little boys. So when we hit the border crossing, I turned to the children and right out of nowhere, screamed at them. Scared them so they'd be crying. Because they don't mess with you when you've got crying kids and dirty diapers. That's remorse. Forever. Broke the bond between me and my kids. That's regret. That's remorse. There is no payback for that except the one I found here. In the fourth step, there is a promise that is so profound, face and be rid of. I didn't come here to just get fixed. I came here to be changed into the kind of person who's not capable of committing that act ever again. That's the only thing I know to do with it, Will. A change so profound that I'm no longer that person. Now I still have to deal with the fact that I've got to clean that up for the kids. They're scarred. And will always be scarred. But I can create an arena where they can get better from it. So the answer is change so profoundly you could never do that again. Total surrender. As long as I'm capable of committing that kind of an act, I cannot live with myself. I can't. Can't deal with it. How can you deal with that kind of thing? You just have to be different. Okay? And that's what I did find here. That's precisely what occurred. Then the next job is to tell you that so you can get off your own back. Because like it or not, that's the best I could do. That's pretty shabby. I'd rather die than be that ever again. But you don't have to die. You get to be something even better.
Let me mention two different levels of remorse that I think about, Wilker. One is that remorse comes when I fail to follow my hunches. That and what I'm talking about, and I'm talking about a different level of it, of the day-to-day things that are building up remorse. Because what I found is that when I listen to my hunches and I do what I feel the urge to do, if I don't do it, I always regret it. Because it's a real message. You know, if I've got a friend sick in the hospital and I have a hunch that I ought to go see him, if I don't, deep, deep remorse. Because, and I think that's the signals, you know, about being in tune with the call it voices, if you will, but the things that I feel spiritually driven to do, and those hunches. And if I take over and impose my judgment, I'll nearly always have remorse about that. What I've learned is that my first hunch, even, you know, whether it's a spiritual signal or not, but my first impression about something is usually the most correct one I'll ever have. And if I follow that up with a whole bunch of thinking, all I do is screw it up. And after a certain amount of a whole bunch of turmoil and confusion, I wind up right back where I started. But I'm often too late. So that's one level. The other that I think like the kind Don's talking about. Our program is designed to provide the surgery for the soul, that you know, from deep remorse like that. And I have some. I think we can sort of visit steps a little bit with this thing. You know, I believe that what starts to emerge in the fourth step and then gets crystallized in the eighth and ninth are the surgery of the soul. You know, where I start getting, rooting out those causes and conditions and the enormous damage that has come from my defects of character. And my belief is, whether it's true or not, it's certainly my belief, is that every time, whether it's gravity like he's talking about, or gravity like in my case where I took human life, you know, all of these things have an enormous weight. And so do those far lesser things that make up an amends list. And my belief is that I will never have the freedom that this program promises until I take that surgical procedure and give it my best to make right those wrongs. And so it's one thing to recognize it and deal with it, but if I don't have to figure it out and deal with it, what I have to do is take the steps and let it happen. And if we don't, I think we pay an awful price, because those things become the anchors that we drag through life. And I won't be free till I'm able to turn them loose. And just kidding myself that it wasn't all that bad is not enough. Just having somebody try to placate me and say, oh, you weren't that bad, is not enough. You know, what I have to do is root out those things that eat me up. And so, I think the steps directly put us through at whatever level, so that we can find peace.
This kind of thing is about being shabby. I described the high intensity, high drama piece. The children were in no real danger. Don't mistake that. Had we been caught, they'd have been better off, because they'd have gone to at least a decent foster home. What I did to my children is that, for no reason whatsoever, I broke the spiritual bond between us. I harmed them to accomplish my own ends. Totally self-serving. And that's what inventory brings me to every case. It's shabby. It's about me wanting a little prestige. It's about me wanting this or that, a little money or whatever. And that's the one that's hard to face. That on my own, I am nothing. It's very clear. Left to my own devices, at my very best, if there's 10 people in the room, at my very, very best, I can help 9 of them. Somebody's going to get screwed. In God's hands, I have found that even the onlookers benefit. Nobody gets messed with it. Even people just crossing the street. Okay. Two little pieces for the prayer that goes along with this. This whole thing is about me getting conscious of a relationship with God. We asked for guidance and direction. Well, there was an old Assembly of God preacher who used to come into the penitentiary, and I discovered that I like spiritual people. I don't care what they call themselves. And I love singing hymns. We shall gather at the river still brings tears to my eyes. If you sing in the garden, I'm dead meat. And this guy, I had this illusion that spiritual people were perfect, and he was one. And yet he said he had difficulty sometimes and temptation sometimes. We asked him, what do you do? He said, well, when I'm tempted with something and I'm not sure, see, I know the difference between right and wrong. It's the gray area that I get in trouble. If I'm not sure, he said, I take the master by hand and say, if I go do this, will you go with me? And I got my guide. Okay. Today's guide is a little different. It's a little more personal. If what I'm about to do, would it be all right if my mother, my wife, my daughter, my granddaughter saw me do it? If the answer isn't absolutely yes, I'm not doing it. It just gets real simple and basic that way. And the temptations are even harder as you get rid of your defenses against your temptations. Okay. It's really tough. Well, I won't really hurt anybody. But that, in relating to that, clearing away self puts me in... See, the spiritual life is a very practical life to me. Anything that separates me from the children of God separates me from God. And since the whole idea of God's bigger than I can even begin to comprehend, the mercy of AA is that it deals with it on this level. Okay? One of the old masters says, treat people like you want to be treated. Because what goes around does come around. And those are some of the guys. I must engage in this thing. I've got a lovely guy, sober several years now. Never talks a meeting, never does nothing. He's just miserable. He's in deep depression. Of course he is. He'd get up and sing for a minute, it'd be over. But he doesn't know how to sing. Or doesn't want to sing, or whatever. Anyway, does that help a little bit? There are no pat answers for this. I must behave as if God were at hand, because where I am, God is. And if he wants me to run my head into the wall, or if I want to run my head into the wall, he stands by and lets me. Keeps the bandages handy. If I don't want to run my head into the wall, all I got to do is ask for the strength to do the right thing. And when I ask, will you go with me? If I get a strong yes, I go. And that's the toughest one of all. That's the hardest one. Because I know it's going to... I'm going to be doing something that's extraordinary if I say yes to that and go. If I get a no, I don't go. If I don't get either one, I don't go. That's the grave. That's where the doubts are. If you're not sure you ought to do it, don't. Don't. Find out why you're in doubt.
I might have missed it, but your temptations get harder as you lose your defense against your temptations. Help.
I am more vulnerable to drinking today than I ever was before because I don't see alcohol.
Yeah.
It's not part of my mind. The mental obsession with alcohol is gone. I don't even see it. 15 or so years ago, I was flying home. I think those of us who are sober a while are in far more danger of drinking because of the truth than we are lies. You got to all work real hard to come up with enough lies to convince me it's okay for me to drink. I know better. But I'm flying home, and this was a perfect evening. I'd given a talk that didn't hurt anybody. They even drove me back to the airport. They didn't make me walk. I fly United a lot, and on this particular evening, because of that, they moved me into first class. I used to think that's because I had some special thing going. It's because they can't sell that seat, but they can sell mine back here. They just moved me up. That's an ego deflator. But it's nice up in first class. Real food, real plates. It's an evening flight. I'm in fit spiritual condition. I'm going home to the family I adore. I've got a book I've been waiting to read for several weeks. The lights in the first class cabin were just wonderful. And I'm okay. And I noticed out of the side of my corner of my eye, the flight attendant pouring this burgundy red stuff into my seatmate's glass. That's all it was. And I looked over at it because the light was hitting it. And my mind said, that really looks good. Well, that's the truth. It really did. It's not wine. It's that. Then my mind said, I bet that's going to taste good. Of course it would. That's why she's giving it to him. I'm still not thinking alcohol. Then my mind said, I bet that's going to make his whole dinner taste better. That's the main function of wine, you know. It cuts the grease from the last course, and this one you can taste it. Okay. Then a prayer began in me. I don't know how to describe this to you. I just know that I absolutely trust this inner resource, the spiritual resource, to protect me when I don't even know I need protecting, when I'm in the gray zone. There's a sense that comes over me. And I immediately turned and went in and just got quiet and realized my very next thought would have been, I probably ought to have one of those without ever thinking alcohol. That's how vulnerable I am today. The temptations are much more I've got to really stay fit. Okay. We're out on the road a lot. There's a lot of danger out here. I don't know if you know that or not. There's grave ego danger. There's grave physical danger. There's grave emotional danger. And it's real easy to cave into that. After 50 people tell you you're just wonderful, you begin to think maybe they're right. That means that I have special privilege. And that's where my ego goes with it. And no, I don't. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah,
okay. Pardon me, I'm a storyteller. You got to get it all because I don't know anything.
I tell you, the part of temptation, and I want to kind of lead this around and talk about that emotional recovery thing a little bit too. The more critical kinds of temptation stuff are matters of principle things. You know, like now I'm not cured, but it's been many years since I've had a real crisis in terms of drinking. That doesn't mean I'm cured. Because I know what causes that to be so. But where I run into difficulties now is that as my life has changed and I've become a participant in life and a responsible person, I have to make a lot of ethical, principle-based decisions that are sometimes tough to make. And with most older members, that's where I see the real crisis coming. It's about values and what you stand for. And so I find a lot more threatening stuff that I have to be diligent about in terms of cutting corners, of not being scrupulous about the way I do business. So, you know, the ones where it becomes the glaring thing of the burgundy, yeah, I can deal with that. But the more subtle ones that kind of take away my integrity are the ones that I really have to watch out for. You know, trouble with booze to me is always at least 6 months ahead of a crisis, at least. And it has to do with starting to lose that sort of sharp focus and clear kind of plug into the program. You know, it's a strange thing, but you can watch somebody headed for trouble. Probably everybody here has seen somebody or may know somebody right now that's headed for trouble and you know it. Everybody recognizes it, but everybody is equally baffled about how to deal with it. Now, how do you do it? You know, and how you charge in? Sometimes you can charge in and do far more harm than good. But you see it. You start seeing it in behavior. You start seeing it in that squishy thing called attitude. You start seeing it in performance at meetings and stuff like that. But how to step in and intervene is a real deal. My group spent 4 hours recently in a workshop on working with people, and that was one of the things we talked about. What we wound up seeing, the consensus of that group, was something I was talking about this morning. It depends on the level of trust. The person who can most apt to be able to step in is the one with the greatest level of trust. If you have that trust, there is absolutely no limit to what you can do with an alcoholic. There's no limit to what you can say. If you don't have it, it's a pretty narrow limit to what you can do. And so it's a, to me, those are where we tend, and it is about emotional recovery. It's about being sound and solid in. Somebody asked me a good while back, to do a workshop on emotional recovery. Now, I'm a kind of a down-to-earth type of fellow. And my first reaction, even though I know that it's a legitimate term, my first reaction was, hell's bells, I don't want to do a workshop on some touchy-feely stuff like that. And then I thought, well, there's no real set agenda. I can do what I want to do. That's what they said. Kind of like we're doing here today. I didn't know till lunch what the program was. Well, but I'm looking at this thing of emotional recovery and how we're going to tackle it. And so I sat down, and in 20 minutes, I did what anybody in this room could do. I thought about what is it that destroys emotional, what is it that tears up emotional recovery? You know, I mean, it's one thing to talk about the wonderful nirvana of sound emotional recovery, but what is it that eats it up? And you could do the same thing I did. I sat down, and in 20 minutes, I listed 28 things, just in a brainstorming style. You know, here's stuff that happened. First one I put on the list was expectations. And my God, and no wonder I put it first, because I don't know of anything in the world that'll pull me off good, sound, emotional recovery than putting on expectations on other people. All I've got to do to destroy my peace of mind is put expectations, because what I do is let them have free space in my head. And I am absolutely done for, because I've turned it over to somebody else. And just little things you'd think about. Getting overcommitted. Feeling like you're carrying the world on your shoulders. Worry. The thing he mentioned this morning that sounds really innocuous. A little thing called change your mind. Change your mind. If you think about what we have, we have a spiritual hold on a new way of life. And all I have to do to lose it is change my mind. And that sucker can be gone in a heartbeat. And so that thing of keeping spiritually sound and keeping emotionally sound is tremendously important. And we had a good time doing that thing on emotional recovery. And so, to me, that's the imminent danger, is when I start eroding that sound spiritual ground that I stand on. And no matter what I sell it out to, and you can make your own list of things that take that down. And so what deals with it? I'll let you in on a little secret. It goes a little bit to steps that I'm not somebody who works on problems. I literally don't. And the reason I don't is because when I work on them, they, honest to God, get worse. They really do. If I'm trying to fix remorse, like we were talking about, if I'm trying to fix guilt or trying to work on relationships or whatever, you know, I'll guarantee you I'll make it worse. And what I found is that the way that I work on the problems of my life is by trying to do what the program lays out. That little thing in the 12 and 12 that I have come to really appreciate, where it describes what the steps are, it says almost exactly this. I know I screwed up a little bit, but you recognize, is it says our steps are a set of principles, spiritual in their nature. You tell me what my tools are. Which, if practiced as a way of life, that thing about you working the steps, doing the steps, writing the steps, seminaring the steps, you know, to me they're off the subject. You know, those are nice activities, but what the real key to the steps is in practice them as a way of life. And what I've found, and it's absolutely been my experience, that in 45 years, I have never consciously solved one single problem in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not a single one. I have never sat in a meeting or sat with a sponsor and said, "Eureka, I finally got it." It has never happened. You know, what I find is that as I practice this set of principles as a way of life, amazing stuff happens. Emotional sobriety happens. Remorse gets dealt with. You know, all of the things that constitute my alcoholism get addressed. And so to me, that whole business about, you know, if there is an emotional recovery, there's not any recovery. You know, that whole business is how to be free of those devils that drove me. And so that's the way I like to go at this kind of stuff. I don't like to just set little goals and do stuff and do mechanical actions, you know, that. What I like to do is give myself to this program. When I've got trouble, I never pursue the trouble. What I do, we were talking about it a little bit last night. that what I do is I get focused like a laser on what I'm doing. You know, I get focused like a laser. I go to meetings, and I listen at that meeting like it's a Sermon on the Mount. Now, I don't care if God's teaching you how to throw up. I'll listen like I've never heard, you know, because I want to get locked in. You know, I want to get really geared in. And so that's how I go about dealing with problems. I don't try to fix them out yonder somewhere. I try to fix them by getting solidly tuned in to who I am, to what I'm about, what my spiritual life is, so that I get solidly connected. And then when I get like that, I'm about as strong as they come. And when I try to fix it out yonder somewhere, I'm about as weak as can be. And so that's not just frothy philosophical stuff. You know, that is truly what I believe happens. And it's certainly been my experience that if I practice this as a way of life, stuff just happens. And those problems that eat me alive, one day I take a look and they ain't there. I don't go looking for them. Because I know how to find them. All I had to do is just quit doing what keeps them out there, and they'll be back. You know? That's a powerful area. Yeah.
Practical story about what he just said. How do I apply this on the street? That's what I have to keep looking for. I was working in community corrections in Denver. You have to understand the corrections system itself is designed to fail. If you're going to work in it, you need to know that. So that you don't. So I got a probation officer here. I was treatment services supervisor, so I'm here. And I got my boss here and a couple other department heads here. Now, she sends me a piece of paper. I do something with it. I send it to them so they can get it to here so they can get back to them through me back to her. That's designed to fail. Somewhere it gets bogged down. She's under pressure, and she's yelling at me. And for a couple weeks, okay. Then she starts yelling at my boss, and he starts yelling at me. Now I've got two of them yelling at me. And it wasn't okay anymore. Now I know something. One of the basic principles of this thing is if I'm disturbed, it's me, not you. It's me. I've got to deal with me. So I sat down and did inventory the way I've been taught to do it. Because I caught myself. I listened to myself. I heard myself tell one of my staff about the bitch. Right now I know I'm completely out of whack. Her name is Stephanie, not the bitch. And so that immediately triggers me to lock my office door. Don't talk to anybody else. Because I'm starting to mess with my own staff. Stupid thing to do. Anyway, I got pulled in and discovered what was going on. First of all, I want my boss to quit yelling at me. I don't care if she yells at me. But I do care if he yells at me because he pays my check. And he and I have an agreement. If he yells too much, he gets this. That's the guy I work with. And I wasn't ready to do that. So I looked at what was going on. It's all about her yelling at me because this paperwork that she had a timeline on wasn't back here yet. And that's because these people hadn't done theirs yet. Blah, blah, blah. The monster in the case was the fax machine. I get the paperwork and I go to fax it to her and there's an hour wait to get the fax to her. Either hers is busy, mine's busy. That whole thing is jammed up. You have taught me the basic principle here is one-to-one, eyeball to eyeball, not telephones, not fax machines. We're going to talk together. Her office was about 10 minutes away. So I took the paperwork and drove over there. And she was shocked to see me. Gave her paperwork. And I asked her, do you have any for me? She was shocked at that and got confused. After a week of that, the problem was solved. And in 25 minutes, instead of an hour, waiting for the facts, the problem was solved. She's no longer a threat to me. My boss is no longer a threat to me. I'm like you, I don't try to solve that problem. What's wrong with me? What can I bring to the situation that will make it better? The recognition that she's under the same pressure I am, She got somebody yelling at her. No wonder she's uptight. It worked, by the way. Last time I saw her, she came clear across the room and put a hug on me. Which was not what I had in mind, but it worked. I don't mind that. This goes to the street. Prayer is an activity, as well as an in-the-head thing. It's an activity. How can I bring about unity in my whole life? Well, that's how. Emotional sobriety means I recognize when I ain't. Right off the bat, I recognize I'm out of whack here. The bitch just called.
Let me tell you one little war story. That you know, sometimes it is, when I first heard people talking about the spiritual life and how you had to live it, and like this morning you talk about I sing about it, but it actually was my image when I would hear people talking about the spiritual life and how it worked. You're talking about how you found that parking place, you know, describing that, and he's in the right place at the right time, and there's the parking. When I heard people tell this stuff like that, I thought, gee, what kind of witchcraft is this? That yeah, it sounded like they just prayed and somebody's car blew up or something, you know, and they just made the world turn around for them. I thought, gee, that is just pure junk. And then now I talk that way. But now it makes sense when I talk that way. But it's the same message, you know. But if you're not tuned into that, it really sounds goofy. And what I found is that the spiritual life, just like that, it's not just some sort of squishy, do-good, grinning Dalai Lama stuff. It really is about how to function effectively in life. And it works. I'll tell you one of a thousand stories. I was heading a pretty large organization, and I had something done that was really malicious and underhanded and injurious to people that worked for me. You remind me of that with that story. And you know, I think as a supervisor, you're not only responsible for getting work out, you're also responsible for looking after the welfare of the folk. And so I had 41 people whose careers were going to be destroyed over a decision that was made, and I'm the boss, and they hadn't even consulted me, you know. Well, I mean, I was mad. I was mad. I was mad on behalf of the 41 people, and I was about equally mad over the total disregard and insult to walking past me to screw my people. And so, I mean, I was fit to be tied. And I said, well, I demanded an audience. I demanded an audience of the head of the system. And I guess I had enough rank that they respected the demand, and so they gave me an audience. Now, if you can picture this, and this is absolutely true, exactly the way it happened, and why the spiritual life is not a wimpy thing. I'm mad, and I've got in my mind that I'm going to handle this sucker street level. You know, I'm going to go in there and flat stick it in their ear. And so I'm going to meet with seven people. And most of the seven had directly benefited from the action that had been taken. So I got to go meet with my enemies in my mind that had done me in and profited in the process. And I'm going to go in there. So all I can think about is I'm going to flat put them down. And I'm driving to the meeting, spoiling for the fight. And on the way up there, thank God it was a long drive. And on the way, I got to thinking about who I am and where I'm going. And I thought, my God, is this the way I take care of business? That the only thing I can think of is to resort to the old street behavior, go up there and try to bang up on somebody or whatever. And then I thought about what our program says. Is to pray for those folk. And so what I did, driving up US-1, was I put the face of each person visually in my mind. I knew them all well. And so I put each one of them right there, and then I prayed directly with that face in my mind. Virtual reality was there. And I gave them the benefit of the doubt. I said, well, maybe these folk are wrong, but they're probably doing what they believe is right. Now, I did that 7 times because picturing those people. When I got through, I was no longer angry. I was still resolute, but I was not angry. And we went into the meeting, and I sat down with those folks. And it took a long time because I had to go through 41 decisions and present my case for why that was a bad decision. At the end of the first day, I hadn't lost a round. I mean, I had won everything that came up. But I couldn't lose. When I went in there, there was no way I could lose. If it had all gone the wrong way, I was at peace. But I was determined that I was right, that I was trying to do the right thing, that I was not trying to be right. I was trying to do what was right. And at the end of that day, I was really on a roll. Man, I'd won everything. And the boss said, "Tom, we're going to have to call a break." And I didn't want a break. I'm on a roll. Why am I going to quit? And I said, no, let's don't do that, man. I got to drive 75 miles. And he said, "You got us beat numb." I said, "All right, fine, I'm going to do that in short." Came back the next day, and it hadn't even changed. I mean, it picked up again. Out of 41 major issues, I lost one. I think I could have won that one. But I just didn't want to rub their nose in it. But you see what I'm talking about? If I had gone in there using the old Ivester strategies, they would eat me alive. I would have walked out of there with no gains and more losses if I'd have done it my way. And that's why I say to you, I don't have to do this stuff. If I let the power of the program take care of giving me what I need, I'm a pretty doggone worthy adversary. But if you let me try to do it on out-slicking or out-toughing or out-smarting people, shoot, I'm going to lose a lot more than win. And so, to me, that's what this thing is. It's about not some doormat approach to life. It's about being able to take a good, responsible position in trying to do something according to principles, you know, so that it don't get lost and weak in the process. And just truly amazing things happen. And that's literally one of hundreds of cases that I could tell you where that genuinely worked for me. I'll tell you one more that it's a shorter one, but it's just as effective to me. I got a call one day to go make a presentation on behalf of an agency, and I thought we were just going to go sit around a coffee table somewhere. So I was off duty, and so I just went up casually, dressed in an old golf shirt, you know, and I sat down. Well, I didn't know it, but we had a Madison Avenue presentation scheduled. And I walk into a real ritzy conference room and I've got people sitting in there who are my competitors who had productions that were produced in Hollywood, I think. Man, they had videos and computers, and I had a legal pad. You know, I walk there looking like a real doofus, you know, with my legal pad and some scrawled notes. What am I going to do, man? I am absolutely outclassed. I mean, I was a hick in Las Vegas. Totally blindsided. Well, what do you do? When all else fails, try praying. And so I stepped out, went down to the bathroom where I do my best praying. And I asked God to help me do what I was there to do and try to get done what was right. And so I walked in with my little old legal pad, made my presentation, and guess who walked out with it? See what I'm talking about? And it wasn't a matter, I think I had the best deal, but I surely had the ugliest presentation. But when I'm trying to do the right thing and I am genuinely trying to carry out God's will and do what's right for folks, it's hard to lose, awfully hard to lose. And so it's amazing how this thing works out, this spiritual life. And why I don't get into the fix-it business. You know, I just sort of practice thing, let it gear me up to engage in life, and man, it works strong.
Emotional sobriety does not mean that I'm going to feel good all the time. That's insane. Absolutely insane. I live on a planet with temperature ranges of 4,000 or 5,000 degrees. I can handle 10 of them. I'm going to either put something on or take something off or whine. I'm a person who by nature needs to be loved and adored by everybody. That's dumb. There are people who don't like me just because I'm here. They don't even know me. In fact, I think real sanity is the day I recognize that there are people who like me no matter what I do, and there are people that don't like me no matter what I do. But the more important is there are millions of people that don't even know I exist. And wouldn't care if they did. So, I'm not going to feel good all the time. My 16-year-old nephew died. We knew he was going to die from the day he was born. We were prepared for it. It still devastated me. I didn't feel good that day or for several days after. I had to do his funeral service. So what do? I cried all the way through my talk. That's what I did. That's honest. I just have to feel it. I have chronic physical pain. What do? You say hi, Flanagan. You know Flanagan? Very dangerous man.
He had on clothes last time I saw him.
So that doesn't feel good. If I get concerned with not feeling good about not feeling good, then I'm in trouble. So the prayer is, God, don't let me get depressed about being depressed. Don't let me feel bad about feeling bad. Get up off your ass and go do something. Well, I don't want to. Well, who cares? Get up. During the time of the worst time, and I won't go into the whole thing, I was struck almost to death with hepatitis C and some complications. In fact, he saved my life by putting me to work and making me useful in the worst of it. But some idiot came by to visit me. He said if I'd have been spiritually fit, that wouldn't have happened. I bought into that for about 10 minutes and then threw him out. That's crap. But during that period of time, I started looking at my heroes. You see, I want to be better than I am. So I don't want to look down here. I want to look out here. And almost without exception, the people that I consider heroic had severe physical problems, and they just got above them, that's all. They just went and did it anyway. And then I bumped into the little thing that Sister Teresa talked about as to how she came to her ministry. You know how that is? It's wonderful. She's on a train going across Germany during Hitler's time. Was reading about that and the horrors of that, and realized that deep within her was the same capacity for evil that was being demonstrated by him. And it touched her so deeply, she decided she needed to give her entire life to just the opposite of that, so that would never emerge. Okay. By recognizing the evil within me, now I can do some real good. Because if I'm busy over here, this isn't coming up. But I have to always know that deep within me, I'm a lazy whiner who's interested in, where's mine? We ought to take a little break, what you think? Are we heading in the directions you want to go?
Yeah.
Okay. 15 minutes?
Question for you guys.